bus ride somewhere. An earbud turns into a miner inside my ear. He is drinking water from a canteen, talking to someone on a cell. I can feel his head getting sweaty. His voice is raspy.
Trying to blend the science of sending them.
The interior loosens and something gold appears. The gold shakes like an agitated tiger, and the miner swings his axe, cracking the gold in two. He eats both pieces. The chewing echoes until the lonesome feast concludes. Then he immolates. He slams his fiery hands into the floor of my ear and screams. I cannot look anywhere. Jerking violently, he becomes a miniature sun and flows freely through my body as if I were a ghost. And sitting wherever he wants in me, sensing my weaknesses, he projects from his 10,000 flaming mouths an afternoon in which I am completely stupid and what the fuck about everything.
This was A Bus Ride Somewhere by Ryan Bender Murphy. And that is what this episode of Zoom is all about. No, not riding buses, but rather sound, poetry, and technology. My name is Axel Buhlmann, and today I'm interviewing Jeff Borizak, poet, scholar, and member of the Penn Sound Archive, about poetry and new media. And I also talked to Ryan Bender Murphy, whose poem we've just listened to, about Hardly Donuts, the new online poetry magazine he is launching. Welcome to Zoogma. So, let's talk to Jeff Borizak. Is it okay, Jeff, if I introduce you as a poet gone critic?
Yeah, somewhere in between. I mean, the best poets are also critics, and the best critics are also poets, right? I mean, what I like about poetry is that there's a lot of crossover between the two. I got my BA from the University of Pennsylvania, concentrating in poetry in 2010. And then I spent 2 years working for Penn Sound, where I was digitizing a lot of cassette tapes for them, working on their website. And then I came here in 2012, but continued to do work for Penn Sound since then. So the very first seeds of Penn Sound actually started 10 years ago. The idea was that there's been this long history of poets recording themselves, recording readings. They just language on cassette tapes, which, you know, as you know, is unstable magnetic media. It's eventually going to decay. But beyond that, there was a lot of valuable material, a lot of historical readings that people had that just weren't widely available. It was just depending on a poet making a bootleg for you. So Charles Bernstein and Al Filreis of the University of Pennsylvania got together to start this project called Penn Sound. And the idea was that they would both take these old recordings and digitize them and make them, first of all, label them in a way that you could easily find them and sort through them, because a lot of stuff was also just like unnamed real media files, right? So make them MP3, easy download, easy to stream, widely available with the author's permission on the internet. And then also just start recording things that were going on at the University of Pennsylvania campus and getting stuff from other readings that were going on around the country. And building this online archive of really, I think some of the oldest stuff is, the oldest thing might be Bochel Lindsay reading, which is in like the 1910s. There's some Gertrude Stein and Ezra Pound on there from in the 1910s, 1920s. So the idea was to have this 20th century readings, lectures, discussions, and have it be something that's living, something that's continually going on. It's almost exclusively authors reading their own poetry. Obviously, some people do like what in music would be covers sometimes. And there's also significantly Pensound Classics, which is part of the website, which is some poets and professors reading Milton, Dryden, Swift, Poe, Shakespeare. So older, obviously, much, much, much older poets. But for the most part, the material is the poets reading their poetry themselves. It's not about doing the highest quality, like the official standards, highest quality recordings. Its access is very much emphasized. So which is why they're MP3s, when I think a lot of archives typically use WAVs. But WAVs are so much, they require more space, they're not easily downloadable, they're not meant to be shared in the same way. So a lot of the emphasis is on access and letting people actually listen to this poetry. I've done a little bit of sitting down with poets and doing recording sessions as well. I did some of that in Philadelphia. I actually traveled to Boise to record Martin Corliss Smith, who's the head of the Boise State University English program, wonderful poet. So some recording, some just maintaining the website in a lot of ways. It's a pretty simple HTML website, but it obviously just needs a lot of work constantly. Pensound is really open about just including pretty much everything that we have permission for. Really, I think there are two things that we don't put on the website. One is things that we don't have permission for, either from the poet or from their estates, and there are many instances of that. A lot of authors, rightfully so, are protective of their work, and we are very good about respecting that. The only other thing that has been taken off the site are the recordings of Ezra Pound's fascist radio speeches in Italy. They were put on the site very early on, but they ended up just getting linked to by neo-Nazi websites and groups. So they had to be taken off. We have them available for academics and scholars that are interested in them. So we do hold on to those. But I think that's the only instance where we had something and we just couldn't put it on there for a reason that wasn't related to the rights, the author's rights.
And did working with audio versions of poetry rather than reading it on the page, which is often the default nowadays, did that change the way you understand it at all?
I think the sound aspect of poetry is very important and definitely changes the way that you understand poetry. Very recently my students read Gwendolyn Brooks' We Real Cool, which I think is a great example of a poem that as soon as you hear Gwendolyn Brooks reading, the poem just opens up in a completely different way because there are lots of sound aspects. It's a persona poem, and you can hear that even when you can't necessarily read it. As far as my experience actually sitting there and listening to these things that I didn't know of, I discovered so many poets just going through that. But yeah, I mean, obviously poems change between when they're read and when they're published. I would come across poems that I liked, I'd go and look them up in the library, and it'd be a different poem because it was just at a different stage that it was actually read. And also, I mean, that opens up what's going on in the poem in new ways, too, is just listening to those different versions as they were recorded. I mean, Ginsberg talks a lot about how he would write with the length of the page being the space of one breath. And so he would write until the end of the page, and that would be what you would say verbally in one breath. He took the idea from William Carlos Williams, although Ginsberg's lines were much longer, and he would often say it's because I can hold my breath longer than William Carlos Williams. But I think that's a good example of how you can't separate them entirely. I think it's a little misguided to say for many poets to say that there's a definitive version in that way. In Howl, there's a moment where there's a bunch of asterisks, and Ginsberg for many years didn't read that word until I think several decades after he had published the poem and been reading the poem, and he finally decided that he could say "fucked" in that spot when he was talking about his mother. So it took a while for him to say what was not on the page, but I don't think that makes the verbal version any more authentic or than the written version.
Do you think in general it has become harder for poetry to find an audience, given that we're becoming so oversaturated with information? Has the battle for attention become a tougher one?
I mean, a poem is always fighting a losing battle in new media environments in terms of what people are going to pay attention to. The most public thing, I think, is slam poetry. Slam poetry has obviously gotten a lot of attention in recent years. Probably the most popular form on YouTube for people to watch it and listen to it. I'd hesitate on thinking of it as like this strict commodity. A lot of people write about this, like, how do you separate like product and commodity when poetry is something that, you know, doesn't really have that exchange value. So in terms of like fighting for people's attention, I mean, I think doing something like making audio recordings much more widely available increases the visibility at the very least. It makes it more accessible. You don't have to go to the library. You don't have to live somewhere where there's like a good small press bookstore that would actually carry a lot of people. In the case of Penn Sound, it's a place where there's very famous writers, contemporary lesser known writers, series that just take place in one city. So you get some of the local poets that are passing through, speaking there, and it becomes a good way just to be exposed to a lot of different poetries, even if there's not like a definite like exchange value, commodity value, something like that. Most people would say that it was always struggling for attention. But poetry is also, especially in the 20th century, had a really strong relationship with, I guess, what you would call DIY culture, right? Going through the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, like the invention of the Xerox and like Xerox machine and using mimeographs were incredibly important for poets to create little magazines and little journals and just circulate those ideas to make their own like self-published chapbooks. So there's always been this connection between like recognizing that poetry doesn't have the same commodity value as other products, but then using the available technology as a means of distribution to build communities. And I think that's an especially interesting link between our current digital environment and the history of a lot of poetry. And in fact, there's a lot of efforts online right now to archive a lot of these little magazines that are really like people just have to find in garage sales and stuff like that, unless someone like did a really good job of collecting every single one and holding on to them. But, you know, there's a lot of people when they were young doing a lot of important work that in 10 years would be huge. And it's just, you know, it's on a piece of paper that was, you know, mimeographed.
And I'm also interested not only in how technology shapes the market and the audience for poetry, but what it does to form, content, and method.
I mean, the idea of like thinking about the digital environment in poetry is so, so huge, and there's so many different projects. In some ways, like the digital environment has been very good for a lot of poetry projects to kind of realize the potential that they always wanted to. A lot of this work is around chance-based composition. So, you know, through the 50s, 60s, people are getting interested in Eastern culture, and the I Ching, the Chinese Book of Changes, becomes especially interesting to a lot of people as a composition method. And in that, you would cast sticks, and you would go to a certain page based on what was cast, basically like a roll of a die. And so this chance-based composition became really, really important to a lot of people. And so one project that I was thinking about a lot was Robert Grenier's Sentences. And so that project was a stack of several hundred index cards, each one with a single sentence printed on them. And part of the idea was that you would read them, you would get the cards mixed up, they would end up in a new order, and you're reading sentences, so it's changing every time you read through it. They've decided to release an online version of this, which is just excellent. It takes that idea, that combinatory aspect of the work, to a level that it could never reach, just being that material object. And also promotes access, right? Which is, once again, one of the biggest things. One of the other digital projects that I think is really interesting is work with emoji. So like last year, there was Emoji Dick came out, which was a translation of Herman Melville's Moby Dick into all emojis, basically advanced forms of emoticons. They're little images that express emotions. They can be of objects as well. But right before Emoji Dick came out, I saw in Smoking Glue Gun, which is an online magazine run by Taylor Pate and Blake Pate, two MFA poets here at UT Austin. And it was emoji poems and their translations. And so the way that would work is that one of them would text the other just strings of emojis. And then the person receiving the string of emojis had to write a poem that translated those emojis into English. And I would encourage anybody that's interested to go to Smoking Glue Gun and look them up. But yeah, those are just two examples of the way people are using digital spaces to kind of work through this material. And then a lot of my own interests, my own critical work, involves conceptualism and Flarf, which are two schools of poetry that are really thinking about poetry as responding to a moment in the digital landscape, trying to think about language and how it occurs on the internet. So conceptual poetry, coming in, the genealogical vein of Marcel Duchamp and Andy Warhol, in the conceptual art of the 1950s, 60s, poetry composition is being based around an idea. So there's a general concept, an idea behind the poem, and that's what kind of motivates it. It heavily relies on appropriation as a form, so just copying text, rewriting text, deforming text. And really, I mean, it's such a huge field, and I'd feel bad like putting it into like little boxes. I would send people to either the July-August 2009 issue of Poetry Magazine, which has a portfolio on conceptualism and Flarf. I would also send people to Kenneth Goldsmith and Craig Jorkin's anthology Against Expression, which came out in 2010. And I'll Drown My Book, which is an anthology of conceptual writing by women, which came out in 2011. Now, Flarf is one of the more interesting to me. So Flarf started actually on an email listserv in the early 2000s, where a few poets were musing about those websites that are like, enter your poem into our contest, and if you win, we'll publish it, and then you get the book. And the trick is that everybody wins, right? And they're just trying to sell you the $40 book that has your poem published in it. So the discussion was, could you write a poem so bad that they would just refuse to publish it? And so it was a bunch of poets just writing like really ridiculous, dumb poetry. And of course they all got accepted by this contest. But so that evolved a little bit. And a lot of these people started using Google searches to kind of get the language material to start composing their poetry. So people do it in different ways. Some people like to just go through the results page on Google. Some like to click the links and draw their language from the websites themselves, just to get the language material and then sculpt these poems, which are often very humorous, obviously, oftentimes very serious. Number of poets doing this, Drew Gardner, Kaislam Muhammad, Katie Degentesh, Nada Gordon, Sharon Mesmer are some of my favorites. Yeah, I mean, algorithms in writing poetry is something on its own too that's really interesting. One of my favorites is Issue 1 is something that gets talked about a lot, written by a few Penn students several years back. And what they basically did was they wrote an algorithm that searched the internet for the name of every poet it could possibly find. Mostly living, a few dead ones slipped in there, but the idea was that every living poet would be included. And then it had a program that would generate poems, and then it would attach a name to a poem, and then they published this 1,000-plus page PDF online. And it caused this huge controversy, because every poet in America wakes up one morning, and of course, poets have Google alerts on their names. And so they see that they've published a poem that they've never written. And people just freaked out, lost their minds. So, but it's just as a document, it's really interesting because it's all computer generated. And it just, it calls into question and challenges and notions of authorship and, the ability for computers to generate poetry and, what makes a human poem more than a computer poem. And, I mean, these are the kinds of issues that I think are really at stake when computer programming algorithms come into this.
For anybody who's interested in looking at any of this stuff in any more detail, do you have some advice for our listeners who want to find out more about all of this, where they can go?
Obviously, I would refer everyone to check out the Penn Sound archives at writing.upenn.edu/pennsound. You can also check out Jacket 2 magazine at jacket2.org. Both are very interesting for contemporary experimental work, so you should look at those. I'd also recommend you a collaboration between Penn Sound, the Kelly Writers House at University of Pennsylvania, and the Poetry Foundation is the Poem Talk podcast, which is especially interesting, using the Penn Sound archives to talk about 20th and 21st century poetry. It's been around since 2008, I think. Once a month, they release an episode. It's the only podcast I listen to, except for Zugma. Sorry, This American Life.
Next, I also wanted to get a bit more of a sense of how what me and Jeff talked about plays out locally in a concrete way. Ryan Bender Murphy is a good friend of mine who has just launched a new online poetry journal. It's called Hardly Donuts. And I sat down with him to discuss his motivations and experiences with that.
Yeah, so I guess a lot of poets, when they're starting out, they want to somehow make an effort to be a part of the community. I guess some ways you could do it would be kind of like more like community building within the city that you live in. So I guess like a lot of people do like reading series, or they'll do like zines, like physical things. And so for me, I didn't want to do that because I guess I've already done that before. Yeah, because like early on, I did like little print zines, and then I actually like was a part of a reading series. And those are effective, but I feel like lit journals online have a wider audience. A little bit more control in like how you can make it look like a unique thing and make it a little bit more artistic. And plus, it doesn't cost a lot of money to have an online journal.
Yeah, and you're running it as a one-man business, basically, right?
Yeah, pretty much. I'm sure if, you know, if it gets really big, I'll have other people involved, maybe an assistant editor. But for now, yeah, just like one person. I mean, that's pretty normal, I would say, for starting out.
And so did you come to that with any background in web design?
No. So that's why the website I'm using has a very user-friendly format. Or I'm using it in a very basic way, and it still looks pretty, so that's good.
If you don't mind me asking, why? Why does the world need another lit journal on that?
Yeah, that was funny, because I was thinking about that you were going to ask that question, like, when I was coming over here, and I noticed there's, like, a new burger place they're making on, like, Guadalupe, and I was like, why do we need another burger place? And I think that we need another burger place because sometimes people need to eat and they're very close to where they're at. And I think with lit journals, we need to have things that are kind of like close to what our needs and desires are. And sometimes those desires are not on the internet already. And I think with this journal, it's basically just trying to carve out a space for certain aesthetics that do exist in other journals but maybe are not collected in such a manner that would make it a very obvious statement. A poetry that is still invigorating, but it doesn't use volume, I guess like a loud volume, to have that kind of energy, or to create an interesting landscape or idea. So I feel like a lot of poetry creates a very, maybe not easy, but on the ostensible moving feeling. And so like there's like the famous quote, right, like Emily Dickinson is like, I know I've wrote a poem when like the top of my head has felt like it's come off its shoulders. I think people use that quote as a way to say, I need like a poem that like punches me in the gut. People often do that like through poems that kind of like shout their words, kind of like an Allen Ginsberg poem, right, Howl, right, it's long lines, there's like no punctuation. Constant repetition of who, and very similar to Whitman, right, where it's like the long lines, these declarations that I'm larger than everything, I'm untranslatable, you know, basically this idea that I have to assert myself as being larger than life as a way of, you know, bringing any kind of change to the world.
Do you think that's something that's becoming a more acute problem these days, with where everybody is kind of sending these messages about themselves, and we're just kind of flooded with relatively loud stuff kind of every second of your life?
Well, yeah, exactly. Right, and I think poetry is trying to take some attention from other things that are loud, like, you know, you could say like the internet in general, like articles like Distractify or Upworthy that have these headlines that are essentially trying to get you interested in looking at the article. So it's like, you know, if you haven't, the first 3 minutes of this video, you would expect, but after that, it'll completely blow your mind away. I guess looking at that kind of rhetoric, right? And I think poetry is trying to adopt that in a variety of ways, and maybe other kinds of art, because we have to kind of like fight for people's attention. And so I guess basically it's like a reaction to buying into this whole idea that I have to like really amplify something that wouldn't really need that otherwise. Like, it's kind of like just a, you know, kind of like an outdoor salesman pitching for what I have to offer.
So do you think in general it's gotten harder for poetry to reach an audience?
Yeah, I think that's a hard question to answer, because I think people like to think historically poetry was of something that a lot of people were interested in, but I feel like poetry has always been sort of like an elitist art form, and maybe it actually has become more open-ended because people have been adopting new styles and ways of engaging audiences. In the way you think about this movement, it's like it is kind of like a strange kind of like counter-reaction to how people are reacting to how like technology and media in general is working. With this journal, it's really like the mission statement isn't quite a fully formed idea. It's more so like what happens when you put together a bunch of things that are not shouting, that are not using that kind of like amplified rhetoric as a way to convey ideas. And is the message as important? You know, is it something that people can still be moved or whatever they want to say by? So it's kind of like an experiment. It's like America itself.
You do kind of engage technology a lot, right? In your own writing, for example. Can you speak a little bit to what the role of technology as a topic, as a medium, you know, how your poetry relates to that?
A lot of people are trying to write and have written about technology in a variety of ways. And for my own poetry, I'm interested in writing about technology, but in the sense of not kind of like addressing like the trend or fad of technology. Because I think a lot of, maybe not a lot, but there are writers who like they'll very much like key in on something, or someone will write about like the NSA program, like the prison program. And I think it's important to address technology, but in a way that kind of like addresses a more fundamental quality in it. And also just, you know, not be so focused on trying to like tear apart or like really criticize like one specific thing at a time, but to just really like meditate on what exactly it means to have technology, and is it necessarily an issue? How do we deal with technology as something that will happen, and then what will happen next? So the project I'm working on is called Glitch. That's the manuscript that I put together. And I think the idea of Glitch kind of works with what the journal is, in that I feel like people who write poetry that is loud, or, you know, people that have like a very amplified rhetoric, some are trying to create change. Some people are trying to get a message out, or, you know, and some people are just trying to express, you know, some kind of feeling. And I think with the idea of like a glitch is that there is change, but it's kind of like an unexpected change. And it's kind of, it can be like a softer change, and maybe like a change from within. This idea with like looking at technology and seeing like how things that don't work inside of it create beauty, and things that people don't expect. And that's how it can inspire us.
What's your opinion of kind of translating that into a method for writing poetry? I know there's arbitrary algorithmic compositions. It seems to me like it's performing what you just called for, right? A meditation of the place of technology in our lives and what it actually does to things like agency and authorship.
There's something about how like technology at a certain point can create art itself, or, you know, what does it mean that technology can create art? It is addressing what, you know, like what is technology, what can it do? But I guess in the way that it's addressing technology, it's looking at that kind of more on like, this is like the definition and like, how far can we take it? And I guess for me, I'm looking more at like, how do people interact with it? So I guess the difference between the two is that it's like kind of like a pure technology art discussion, whereas like I like to have the humans still in that discussion. So I'm mindful of things like narrative, which for me is important, and I feel like that's one way that keeps people reading and understanding what's happening in poems. Anything I say sounds stupid, so I can make sure it's
that. Most of the things you say sound stupid to me. So I'll take the one or two kind of average intelligent sounding things that you said.
Okay.
Ryan's poems have appeared in Anti, Front Porch, Phantom Limb and Spork, among others. His chapbook, First Man on Mars, was released by Phantom Limb Press in July 2013. And just to set the record straight, most things Ryan says do indeed sound far from stupid to me.
It has a face.
Good.
Good.
It has a face.
Its hoard of
lies.
Such is now the years restored.
Such is the war that lives.
Is unworn.
Is unworn.
The was the founders has is ours.
Is
momentum behind its gruel.
That were a face slot.
Being was a face that has its
flesh,
odor locates, does rise
from the
silver mountain
among
maps
that
over
the
face and
trunks.
These is our living rules.
This was Logan Fry's poem, It Has a Face. Logan lives in Austin, Texas, and edits Flag and Void with Matthew Moore. He's a reviewer for the Volta 365, and his poetry has appeared or is forthcoming in Denver Quarterly, Columbia Poetry Review, Forklift, Ohio, The Cultural Society, and Best American Experimental Writing 2014. And this concludes today's episode of Zoogma. Stay tuned for our next one, in which Duncan Minch takes a critical look at techno enthusiasm. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter or like us on Facebook.